All right, so we're in 1 Samuel chapter 18, very simple verses, verses 1 through 5. Can I have a volunteer that would be willing to stand up and read out loud, loudly? Yes, Jim. Excellent. So a very simple story. We're getting the setting here. You see what's going on is that David is becoming increasingly more successful. He is on that mountaintop. David now is becoming close friends with Jonathan, which is going to be irritating King Saul because Jonathan is supposed to be the heir to the throne. And King Saul knows this. Hey, I got to do everything I can to make sure that my son will be king. But then there's this other guy, David, that's kind of pushing in on the throne. And so it just kind of adds to the tension here, a very unlikely friendship between Jonathan, the son of King Saul, and David. And so they have this rapid rise through the ranks. All of a sudden, David is in charge. Everything he does is so successful. And the entire people and the entire country is cheering on Saul, cheering on David at this point. Excellent. Now, another volunteer to read verses 6 through 16. Excellent. Wonderful. So we see here the increasing tension that is going on. King Saul is an absolute mess. Right, he is trying to kill David. He hears the people cheering, all singing David's praises and not his praises. And so this is feeding into his mental illness. It's feeding into his paranoia. It's feeding into his fears, all of these types of things. So he's doing whatever he can now to start to eliminate David. Now, we had a very interesting phrase in the beginning of verse 10. Did anybody catch that when we read this, the beginning of verse 10? Does something odd strike you with this verse? Thank you. I got one person saying yes. Do you see this here? An evil spirit from God? Oh, what do we do with something like that? Okay. In fact, when we read the story of David, when we go through the rest of 1 and 2 Samuel on your own, you'll see this phrase appear time and time again. It doesn't appear just once, but appears over and over and over. That God is sending an evil spirit to torment Saul. It doesn't sound fair, it doesn't sound just, it doesn't sound beautiful, it doesn't sound like the God of the Bible, Jesus holding a lamb and playing the, you know, or anything like that. I mean, what do we do with this? So let's look back really quickly. Look at chapter 16. Look at verse 13 and 14, and this will help to shed some light into this. We don't want to ever overlook a serious question like this, but notice in chapter 16, verses 13 and 14, this is the transition when King Saul, when Samuel came and anointed young David at age 14. And we read here in chapter 16, verse 13, so Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him, David, in the presence of his brothers. And from that day on, the Spirit of the Lord came upon David in power. Samuel then went to Ramah, verse 14. Now the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord had tormented him. And so here's what's going on with this, okay? God allowed the people to have the king. Saul was the choice by God. God allowed this to happen. He had God's spirit on him at some point in his life. But then King Saul went through this time when he was been a king for the next 20 years, where he was constantly rebelling and pushing against God. I'm doing my own thing. I'm doing my own thing. I'm going to offer the sacrifices on my own time frame. I'm not going to wait for the prophet to come. I'm going to do my own thing. And at some point, the spirit is removed from him. It's as if he is constantly pushing and pushing and pushing against God. And God says, fine, then I'm just going to step back. And you don't want me to be a part of your life. That is fine. When I step back and step out, then something else is going to step in. Now, is this God actually sending some type of evil spirit into him, or is it God allowing an evil spirit to occur? There's a lot of different commentators that will take different sides on this, and people love to debate that. I really don't, okay? But what we know is this. This is a person at this point that has been pushing and pushing and rebelling against God time and time again. And at some point, when we rebel against God, at some point in our life, it's going to come back negatively to haunt us. We've all experienced this. We see this with our families. We see this with our kids. We see this with our own lives as well. We can only live in rebellion for so long to God, and all of a sudden, the consequences will come back on top of us. And that is what's going on with King Saul here. He is pushing against God, and all of a sudden, he is being tormented because of his rebelling and his sin to God. So God is stepping aside. King Saul is feeling the natural consequences of a life in rebellion to God. It's a life of torment. So jump back into this story. Saul is jealous. He is trying to kill David. David now is the military commander. The entire nation and all the people are singing his praises. King Saul is furious at all that is going on. And we're going to jump ahead to chapter 19. I have just three verses I'd like someone to read. Chapter 19 and verses 8 9 and 10. And this will start connecting into our handout. Chapter 19, verses 8, 9, and 10.
Correct.
Thank you. That night, David made good his escape. And this is the very first thing. I told you in your notes, you have five things that we're going to see that David loses over this next 12-year period. The first thing that David loses, here's number one, is that he lost his position. David is the military commander. He's the one in charge of the army. He's the one that's very successful in battle. Everything is going well for him. Everyone is following King David at this point. And now because Saul is continuing to threaten him, throwing the spear in, just narrowly missing him, David makes good his escape. And what this is talking about here is that no longer is David living in the palace. From here on out, David is in the wilderness and he is in the woods, if you will, hiding out. And so the first thing that David loses is his position. He is very good at his job. He found success. He found his identity. He's a very naturally charismatic leader. He is on the mountaintop of his position. There is nothing higher except the king. And God removes this from his life. And you can think about everything now that David is losing. He's losing the prestige. He's losing the power. He's losing the pay that he had, the friendship, the respect that came with the job. He's losing the palace. He spent time living in the palace and all the trappings of wealth. All of that is gone now. And it's easy to understand, right, how devastating a blow this is to King David. He lost his position. Now, hang on to that. We're going to jump back a chapter, and we're going to look at the next thing that he loses. We're going to look at chapter 18 and verses 20 to 30. Now, this will require a brave person to read. Is there a brave person that will read? Chapter 18, verses 20 to 30.
Thank you.
What did we just read?
Did you read the same thing that I just read? Okay.
A few thoughts about this story that we just read. Saul's daughter must have been very good looking. Did you see what Saul said? Hey, Saul, you can be my son-in-law. I'll give you my daughter, but here's what you have to do. Just all I'm asking for is 100 Philistine foreskins. That's all. And he's doing this, obviously, as a trap, trying to get David to die. David comes back with 200 Philistine foreskins. I've given many bad wedding presents, okay? This takes the cake, all right? I grew up in church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, two services on Sunday in the morning, all right? I don't ever remember reading this story in Sunday school class. This is one of those that we conveniently overtake here. Notice what King Saul is doing, though. I mean, it just gives us a clue of how messed up he is, right? I mean, that he's using his daughter, who loves David, to trap David. I mean, what type of father would do that? I mean, just an absolute mess. So, David, if you want my daughter, that's fine. Just kill 100 Philistines and bring back their foreskins. If you want to know what that means, if you don't know, how do I describe this? If you have any questions, ask Tom Robertson, okay? Just talk to Tom. Talk to your mother. He'll take care of you. So notice what David does here. David, because God is with him, because he can do no wrong, because he's on the mountaintop, he brings back 200. And all of a sudden he becomes... Then the story continues. Look over now. So hang on to that. Now let's jump back to 19. And we're going to link this together. And then verses 11, 12, and 13. So chapter 19, verses 11, 12, and 13. I have a volunteer to read that. A lot easier than the last passage we just read. So. Oh, we can stop there. That's fine. And so then here's what happens. So then now David is married to King Saul's daughter. King Saul comes to kill them. Michael says, go and flee, and I'm going to hide and put an idol on the bed, which is an interesting sub-story right there. What are you doing, David, with an idol in your house? But that's a whole other story for another time, okay? Puts an idol on the bed, and David flees. And this is now the second thing that David loses, is he loses his spouse. From here on out, David is in this 12-year run. Now, he still remains married to Michael, but over these next 12 years, then when David becomes king, he actually grabs a few more wives. And we see David tomorrow when he is with Bathsheba, David has seven wives at this time, totally in against what God wants. But here, what he is losing his wife. He is now running into the woods, and he loses her. From this time on, death and rebellion, messed up kids affect him. His personal life is an absolute disaster. He has 8 different wives in total, sleeps with many other women. His own kids are trying to kill each other and kill him at the same time. It's a soap opera is what it is. It's a tragedy. It's As the World Turns, 3000 BC. And so God now is slowly removing everything that David is holding on to. He lost his job, that position, that thing that he had his identity on. Now David loses his spouse. No longer is his relationship with his wife ever the same. Where else can David turn? I mean, there's few things that David can turn to. Well, there's one person that David can turn to, and it was the person that poured the oil on him, right? The prophet Samuel. And so at the end of chapter 19, and we don't have to read it because it's kind of an odd story, but at the end of chapter 19, David goes and finds Samuel. There's still someone he can turn to, his religious leader, right? The prophet that anointed him. And at the end of chapter 19, David goes and he finds Samuel. He talks with Samuel. Samuel's there with him just for a short time. And all of a sudden, Samuel leaves and David leaves, and David never connects with Samuel again. They never meet again in this life. And it's a series of cascading events is what is going on here. He lost his position. He lost his spouse. And now the third thing that he loses the prophet Samuel. He loses his religious leader, if you will, his religious connection. He loses his spiritual support system. They part ways. And after chapter 19, David no longer ever connects with the prophet Samuel. He was on the mountaintop. He had everything, and now he's slowly removing. God is slowly removing everything that he relied on in life. Well, there's one last place he can turn. He's got his good friend, Jonathan, right? Jonathan is the son of King Saul. He's the heir to the throne. They are the best of friends. We saw that at the beginning of chapter 18, that they made a covenant together, and they're going to be blood brothers and all that. We know very little. The Bible gives us very little about Jonathan, the son of King Saul. We can figure out a few things about him. We know he's about 6'2". He's somewhat socially awkward with a rapidly receding hairline, okay? Oh, my friends, that's a... Jeez. And he's got a good-looking wife, all right? So we know that. That's our best guess of who Jonathan is. But so he's got his close friend he can turn to. Look at chapter 20. I'd like a volunteer to read the first 3 verses of chapter 20. David now goes to his good friend. He's relying upon his good friend. It's the last place he can turn. Where else can he go? A volunteer to read chapter 20, verses 1 through 3. Oh, I love that last phrase there at the end of verse 3. David is saying, hey, there's only death is just a step away from me, is what David is saying there. And so David runs to the last place that he knows. Right? He doesn't have his job, so he doesn't have all of his military support. He doesn't have his wife to go and talk to. He doesn't have the prophet Samuel to go and talk to. The last place he has is his best friend. So he runs to Jonathan and says, Jonathan, you know, what can you do and help me out? And Jonathan says, no, my father would never do such a thing. And David says, no, you don't understand. Death is just a step behind me. I know I'm going to die. And the rest of chapter 20, and you can read it on your own time, is they make a covenant together to protect each other and take care of their kids if anything were ever to happen to them. And at the end of the chapter, in verse 42, Jonathan says to David, go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord is witness between you and me, and between your descendants and my descendants forever. David left, and then Jonathan went back into town, and then they depart. Over the next 12 years, David meets up with his best friend, Jonathan, only once, and they never see each other again. And David continues to descend from the mountaintop into the valley, my friends, where everything that he relied upon is taken away from. And now we see that he loses his best friend. He loses his friendship. He loses Jonathan. And so this 12-year descent, this 12 years of being in the valley, he has lost his position, he's lost his spouse, he's lost his spiritual support. Now forth, we see that he lost his best friend. He's going through a time when God is removing everything in his life. And we ask ourselves, what is left? What else is there that you can hold on to? There's nothing left. There's one last thing that David holds on to, and God removes that from him. We see it in chapter 21. A volunteer to read just verse 10. Simple, straightforward, easy to read. Chapter 21, verse 10. Sure. So King David fled from Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Gath, where have we heard that name before? Yeah, that's where Goliath is from. It said Goliath, the champion, the Goliath that came from the city of Gath. So where is David going? David is going to the enemy. He's going over to the other side. This is exactly the same town where Goliath is from, the guy that he killed, that he grabbed the four other stones for because he has got four other brothers sitting there in town. And so we ask ourselves, David, what in the world are you thinking? You're going right into enemy territory. And so we ask ourselves, well, what's the one thing that David has in common with the Philistines? The one thing that David has in common with the Philistines that King Saul wants to kill them both. And so he says to himself, this is the last place that I can go. And so David then goes to the evil side. And we're going to see here that the king spares him. Look at verse 11 of chapter 21. But the servants of Achish, the king, said, hey, isn't this David, the king of the land? Hey, isn't he the one they sang about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. And David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, the king. So he pretended to be insane in their presence. This is David. And while he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the doors of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. Let's pause right here. So David shows up into the enemy territory, strange place for him to go. It's the last place he can think of that's going to be safe. I don't know why he thinks it's safe. I mean, why would the king save him? You would think the king would want to kill him because he's the one that killed Goliath and the rest of the Philistine army. But for some reason, the king spares him. He shows up there. Everyone recognizes him. They already know because they've been reading the stories. They've been following on Facebook who this David is, right? They know the songs. It speaks to his popularity. It speaks to his fame. And so David has his last plan. There's one last thing I can hold on to here, right? And he pretends to be insane, acting like a madman, clawing on the walls, drooling all over himself. And we ask ourselves, this is the man after God's own heart? Right? I mean, God, you made a mistake, or did you, with Saul, and are you making another mistake again? I mean, you said you're going to be looking for a man after God's own heart, and we see that person, the man after God's own heart, is a 14-year-old. That's the person, and now we see this is the one. This is the one you've chosen, God? Run around screaming insane and crazy. I love what happens here. There's some humor, and look at verse 14 and 15. Achish, the king, says to his servants, look at this guy, he's insane. Why bring him to me? Here's what I like. Am I so short of madmen that you have to bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this man come into my house? This is what every pastor says, right? I've got enough crazy people already, all right? Now, I mean, other pastors say that, okay? Just making that clear from what I've heard from other churches, they say that, right? But every pastor, every camp director, I mean, we all say this, right? I have enough crazy people already. That's what the king is saying. Do I need one more here? I just imagine God looking down at David at this point and going, no, David, no. Come on, David. You're supposed to be a man after God's own heart. We're going to be naming our kids after you for thousands of years. And this is what you're doing, David? And that final thing, that fifth thing that you're going to write down that David relied upon, it's his dignity. And even his dignity is removed from him. He lost his position, he lost his spouse, he lost his spiritual support, he lost his best friend, and finally he loses his dignity here. And so here we have David, right? I mean, he's on the mountaintop. And now he's in the lowest of valleys. 12 years David is on the run. 12 years without everything that he has relied upon in life. 12 years where God is systematically removing everything that he is holding on to. And now he's treated like a criminal. He's treated like a rebel. He's treated like an animal, if you would, out in the woods on his own. This was a man of promise. And now he has absolutely nothing. Not even his dignity is with him. This, my friends, is why we love studying the Bible. This story we're reading today that actually took place occurred 3,000 years ago. But it's so powerful because it's our story as well. We can identify with some of these steps, if not all of these five steps, can we not? Right? But the Bible speaks to human nature, and human nature does not change, which is why we can jump into a story that's 3,000 years old and say, oh yeah, that's my story. This is a story of my life. This is exactly what I am going through even right now. And so David loses his position, right? He loses his job as the military commander. We've experienced this, right? We've been downsized at work or whatever the term is now, and we're newly retired, and all of a sudden we feel like there's a loss of identity that's going on because I used to be doing this, and now I have all this free time, and I don't know who I am anymore. There's a merger at the office and there's no room for us, and so we're left trying to figure out, who are we? Maybe we're coming from one church where we were established and we're coming to a brand new church and we have to reestablish ourselves and we have to reestablish our identity and who am I, and people don't know me here and all these types of things. There's nothing wrong with having our jobs. God gives us our jobs. Work is a God-honoring thing. But when we rely upon our jobs for our identity, for our status, for our self-worth, when we do that, they can easily become substitutes for God. And then God has a way of removing them from us to help us realize that we need to rely on God and God alone, and not our success and not our job and not our the things that we do. It's so easy for us to equate our identity, right, our self-worth with the job that we have. I mean, we all do. I see this all the time when I get together with my pastor friends. We have a group of us, 10, 12 of us that we get together on, and it's usually, you know, how big is your church and what's going on and tell all the great things, and it's like, you know what, what's actually happening behind the scenes, right? That's all the posturing. Let's get behind that, and then let's talk about how are we doing? How's God moving in our life, and how's God changing us? I'm a pastor, yes, but that's not who I am, right? It's the job that I do. Pastors will come and go. That's okay, but I'm a father and I'm a husband. Those are the things that God has called me for, right? My job can very easily turn into a substitute for God. And when that happens, when our jobs become a substitute for God, God has a way of getting our attention, my friends, and removing them from us. Second thing we see there, right? He lost the meaningful relationship. For David, it's the wife, Michal. Now, so many of us go through this with our struggles, right? I mean, this is one of the jobs, one of the things that I do with the role that I have is listening to people and hearing story after story of what divorce does to a family and what death does to a family or the struggles that are going on in the different relationships that people have. There's something about those relationships when they sever, it breaks our identity because we're known as either a couple or this or something like that, right? We rely upon that other person for our identity, either a boyfriend or a girlfriend. When that falls apart, it shatters our world because our self-worth is so connected into these other types of things. And we're wrapped in what others think of us. And when we run into these relationships and when they become substitutes for God, God has a way of removing them from us, not to test us to see how strong we are, because he already knows those types of things, but to get us to realize that ultimately we only need God and God alone, even more so than whatever relationships that we have. David here loses his spiritual support. He loses the prophet Samuel. And sometimes that's the same situation that we go through ourselves. Maybe finding ourselves having to leave a church for whatever reason, or the church that we have has let us down somehow. Right? The pastor has let us down, or the church has let us down. One of the things that we say behind the scenes, well, and up in front in church is at Southbrook is this. I am going to fail you, and I am going to let you down, and you are probably going to fail me and let me down. Let's just get that out of the way, and let's just be honest with us, okay? Right? Churches are like families. I've yet to meet a functional family, whatever that means, right? Churches are like families. Every family's messed up. Every family's got issues. It's just some churches have a lot more issues than others. Every family has issues. Some families have a lot more issues than others. Let's just be real here. Our churches are broken because they're made up of people like us. I had somebody ask me the other day, now that we have 900 people, how many problems do we have at church? Like 900. I don't know. I mean, that's an easy answer, right? I mean, let's just be honest with you. We laugh, but the reality is that so many of us do carry scars from maybe past church experience, past religious experience as well, where a pastor that we admired has let us down and we feel like we want to walk away from the faith for whatever reason. You know, maybe we were close to God when we were a kid, but now, you know, we've been gone for a long time and we're slowly kind of getting back in, all these types of things. All these types of things, our churches, our pastors, our religions, whatever it is that we're following, can be substitutes for God. And when they are, God has a way of slowly removing them from us so we get to rely solely on him. David loses his close friend, Jonathan, right? This happens to us. We move away or we lost a friend, or a friend starts speaking ill of us, or they're jealous for whatever reason. We talk about friendly fire, right? The wounds of a friend seem to hurt more than the wounds of somebody else. Friends can be a substitute for God as well. Maybe lastly, like David, it's our own self-respect that we lose. Sometimes we take that sobering look at our life, right? And we look back at the different relationships that we've had, some of the toxic experiences, the mistakes that we've made, the addictions that we've struggled with, and we go, oh my word, I feel like I've just lost my self-respect. This is what I do most often, is just listen to people who tell me their stories of ashamed of their actions, ashamed of their addictions, or ashamed of the past experiences they've had. And we can identify with David. Oh yeah, We know what this is like, to be at the mountaintop of our experience and come crashing down into what David later calls, right, the valley of the shadow of death. We see this. We all rely on something or someone in this life, my friends, and these things can easily become substitutes for God. And if you're in this process of coming down the mountain, it is painful and it is tough, right? I know I've experienced this. Our son, we joke about it, you know, he's 9 feet tall or whatever, but he turns 15 in just a week. When our son was born, my wife nearly died giving birth to our son. She had to spend weeks in the hospital. It was a terrible ordeal for us. We know what that is like, to go through that pain. Just 7 days after my wife nearly dies and her son is born, I find myself sitting in a courtroom as my parents' divorce is being finalized. You can imagine what is just going on in a young guy's mind, figuring out all these types of things, right? I mean, it was just 10 years ago that our church was ready to absolutely collapse. 70 people meeting in a gym, and that's all we are, and here's a 30-year-old that knows nothing, and now you're the pastor of this broken ship, right? If I'm sure if I think about it, we can probably, all of us, come up with dozens of situations in our life. We can experience this, but here is the hope for us, my friends. The hope is this, and you'll see something there, hopefully it's on your handouts if I did it right. Billy Graham said this great thing. Mountaintops are great for views, but fruit grows in the valley. Mountaintops are great for views, for looking out, but fruit grows in the valley. This is where God works in our lives, my friends. Right? We are on that mountaintop and it is great and it's a wonderful experience. And if we're there on that mountaintop and things are going well in our life, then enjoy it. Relax, be happy about it. Look around and take a good glimpse of all that God has given you. And that's a wonderful thing because those good things have come from God. Every good and great thing has come from God. And that's a wonderful thing. We hold on to that. But guess what? The fruit in life grows in the valleys. It's when we descend from that mountaintop, when we are going through that struggle, when we are going through that hardship, that is when God truly is at work in our life. Because when everything is going well, frankly, I really don't need God. Ooh, did I just say that? When everything is going well, right, I can kind of put God second. At least I feel like I can put God second. But when I'm being crashed down into that valley, that I am calling out to God and leaning on God, fruit grows in the valley. And I look and say, isn't this what's happening all throughout the Bible? I mean, didn't we see Joseph having to be thrown into the pit and then years later spending 20 years in prison before he was able to come out of the prison? Don't we see the Apostle Paul going through the same type of valley experience as well? Don't we even see Jesus having to go through the valley experience as well? This is something that God does with all of his people. This is how God grows his people, my friends. I am not suggesting that if you're on the mountaintop that everything is going to come crashing down. That's not what I'm trying to say. If you are on the mountaintop, if you are in a period of your life where God has poured out tremendous blessings on you, that's a wonderful thing that is coming from God. Use it for his honor and use that for his glory. But we hold on to those things very lightly because they can easily become substitutes for God. And so as Billy Graham says, right, mountaintops are great for views. But fruit grows in the valley. The good news is that God redeems our hardship. He redeems our tragedy. This is the story of Jesus on the cross. God taking the worst thing possible and using it for good, using it to flip around, redeeming it for something absolutely wonderful. And so the question I have for us is, what are you relying on in life? And if we can't answer Jesus, then whatever that thing is that we're answering is going to disappoint us, my friends. It will let us down. And God has an amazing way of using many different circumstances to sharpen us and to change us. And so the question for every one of us is, what are we holding on to? What are we substituting for God? Even good things can be bad if they're substituting for God. It's in the valley of life, my friends, that God wants us to turn fully to him. It's in the valley of life that God brings other people to come alongside of us to help us through this. It's in the valley of life that God brings other Christians to come alongside and say, you know what, I've been there myself, and I'm willing to walk alongside of you and help you as well. And together, we'll go through this valley together. So here's the challenge I have for you, is what are we holding on to? What are we relying upon? David teaches us here from his own life experience, 3,000 years ago, everything that he held on to was slowly removed from his life. My friends, if we're not holding on to Jesus, it will disappoint us and it will let us down. Let's go before the Lord in prayer. Lord, I'd much rather talk about happier topics. But Lord, this is real life. This is our story. We can read into this life of David our story, Lord. We all know what it's like to have those relationships severed, to have those jobs being removed from us, to go through those health scares, to go through those terrible situations in our life, Lord, when we cry out and say, why are you doing this? Lord, I am so thankful that you are a God that does not abandon us, Lord, but you allow us to experience things to get our attention, to bring us back to you, to bring us back to our knees, to bring us back to a point of surrendering our lives to you. Lord, it is so easy to substitute other things for you, even good things, Lord. And I pray that through the story that we see here with David, through his experience, that they could speak to us today. Lord, for my friends that are here, they're struggling because of job situation, because of friendships, because of relationship struggles. Maybe they're feeling the loss of dignity. Things that we've done in our past are so embarrassing, Lord, that no one can love us again. Lord, I am so thankful that your word teaches us there is nothing we can do that separates us from your love, Lord. That your love extends from the reaches of the world to grab us and to pull us close in again. We are so thankful for that, Lord. Lord, you took David through this tremendous valley of his life. And Lord, you still do that with us today, but I am so thankful that you are right there with us to walk alongside of us, that you have given us your son, that you've given us your word, that you've given us other brothers and sisters, Lord, who have been there as well, that can come alongside of us and help to carry us through. Lord, the only hope that we have, the only thing that we can rely on that will never let us down is what your son has done for us by dying on the cross and rising again, Lord. I pray, Lord, that you would convict us to hold close to your son, that you would move us maybe to make a first-time decision for you or to rededicate ourselves to you, Lord, so that we can truly say that we are following you and you alone. And it's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.